This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Like many Americans of his generation, Charles McCann's success story begins with the GI Bill.
It was a tremendous opportunity as I looked at it. And when I found out that the GI Bill was available to me, I jumped at the opportunity to get the education which I wanted.
Well, in 1945, Charles McCann had just finished serving in World War II, and he came home to join thousands of veterans across North Carolina using the GI Bill to go to college. Charles McCann went to NC State, lived with his wife in a housing complex known then as Vetville, graduated 4 years later with a degree in electrical engineering. Before the war, Charles McCann never dreamed he'd go to college. GI Bill still exists, although it has changed over time, and with inflation and increasing cost of higher education, it's essentially worth less than it used to be to the average returning GI. 60 years after the original bill, we're looking at the impact on society, the military, and higher education in the U.S., and more specifically here in North Carolina. So if the GI Bill has made a difference in your life, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-962-9862. Joining us today are Bob Serro, professor of educational research and leadership at NC State, and Dick Cohn is chair of the curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at UNC Chapel Hill. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Thanks. Same.
Bob, the GI Bill has a reputation. It's one of the most well-received bills and well-received pieces of legislation in American history. Millions of veterans were able to go to college, and a middle class was born, in essence. But now, were most of the vets who went to college on the GI Bill like Charles McCann?
Most of the vets who went, Frank, were people who had started college before the war, or who would have gone, but they enlisted right after high school. The estimates are that about 20% of the vets who went to college after the war did so only because the GI Bill made it possible financially for them to do that.
So how many is that?
It's about 440,000.
Of those who they would not have gone, we assume, may
right.
not have gone otherwise.
And some others probably went more than they would have, got more education than they would have, went to grad school, went to law school.
Does it deserve this reputation?
Peter Drucker called it the most important event of the 20th century, and that's the sort of exaggeration that's been surrounding the law for a while. It deserves its reputation as a great law, one of the best laws in American history, but it didn't create the American middle class. It didn't even create the mass base for higher education. Education rates were going up throughout the century. What the GI Bill did was accelerated that increase a little bit. After World War II.
It did create a kind of the suburbs, I guess. That's the other myth about the GI Bill, and I wonder how much of that is true, the fact that people were able to buy houses who couldn't before. Dick?
Well, I think that was a major factor because people got low-cost loans. And at one point, I think one figure was between 1944 and 1949, $4 billion was spent. And at its peak in 1947, something like 40% of the mortgages were related. So I think that it's not just education that was critical in the GI Bill. It was the loans, the mortgages, the loans to start businesses that helped these people get a start coming out of the armed services.
We really should take a step back and define this bill. What was it? And why did it come about? Mm-hmm. What are the main provisions? You talked about the fact that there were loans for small businesses, farms, and or higher education. And was it a choice? Did you have to make a choice as a returning GI, Bob?
No, you didn't. You could use as many of those provisions as you wanted to. Interestingly, Australia, Canada, and a few other allied countries had similar provisions, but you did have to choose there. It was education, or it was free land, or it was a mortgage. But in the United States, you could use any of the provisions.
A fixed pot of money for each GI?
In the education bill, in the education Title II, it was $500 to cover your education expenses, plus a fixed amount for cost of living allowance. It varied between $60 and $90 for a single person and up to another $30, $40 a month if you had dependents. So that part was fixed. There was also unemployment insurance. You could get $20 a month for 52 weeks, the 52-20 Club, it was called.
Mm-hmm. I was interested to see, Dick, that not a lot of the returning soldiers actually used that provision. Am I correct in that?
Well, my figures are that eventually something like half of the people used some benefit. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 8 million out of 16-plus million people who served in uniform in World War II.
And just to be clear, I'm talking now about the unemployment part of that.
Oh, the unemployment part, I don't know. Bob, maybe Bob knows.
Yeah, I think I've seen estimates about one in five used the 5220 Club, but usually for not very long. They could use it for up to a year, but most of them were on for about a month.
877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join our conversation about the GI Bill. Turned 60 today, very successful piece of legislation. Taking a look back at how it affected the economy, society, the military, and higher education, and also taking a look ahead now that things military are once again in the news and very important part of what we're doing. 877-962-9862. Well, we talk about this legislation. I think we perceive it as a kind of reward for services rendered, but that's really not how it came about, Dick.
Well, it was originally titled, or its formal title was the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, and I think it was an effort on two areas. First, a real concern that all these returning veterans would not be able to find work. At the same time, there was likely to be a post-war recession or even depression. Don't forget that there was the Great Depression before World War II. And second of all, there was a real concern about angry veterans. There had been veterans protests in the Civil War. After the Civil War, there had been veterans protest over their bonus money after World War I, really a march on Washington in 1932 that had to be dispersed or was dispersed. I don't know that it had to be by the Army. So I think Congress and the President were looking at this not essentially as a piece of social legislation, as it turned out to be, but a piece of social legislation that would solve an economic problem and solve perhaps a problem of protest or discontent.
And so part of the rationale was if we can park them in school for a few years, we can get this economy rolling and then gradually move people back into the economy and the workplace. So Bob, then the question is, what impact did it have on higher education?
It did a couple of things, Frank. It made the universities expand. When the veterans showed up, they had to build buildings, they had to hire faculty, they had to hire staff. And once they got a taste of the larger enrollments, they liked it and they wanted to keep it going. So the enrollments never went back to their pre-World War II level. They just kept growing. And the other piece of it is that the state legislatures kicked in. The state legislatures funded the expansion of higher education during the 1950s. They saw what the GI Bill could do. They saw the possibilities, and they provided the money. California set the path here, but other states followed fairly quickly.
So, was that part of the bill itself? Did the GI Bill provide money for the institutions, or are you saying that came later?
No, the GI Bill gave the money directly to the student veterans, and that's one of the great provisions. It allowed the veteran to go anywhere that he or she wanted to go.
Frank, an interesting footnote. I went to graduate school in the 60s, and many of my professors had taught those students in the 40s, and they loved those students. Mm-hmm. Those were serious students. These were not goldfish swallowing, binge drinking kids. These were young men who'd seen some awful things, been some far places. They were serious. They wanted to get their education, and they wanted to get it fast.
But you know, that's interesting because there was a debate, wasn't there? There were critics of this bill suggesting that just the opposite was going to happen.
That's right. The presidents of Harvard and Chicago, among others, didn't want to turn the colleges into what they called a hobo jungle. They thought that the standards would be lowered if the gates were open to just anybody.
I didn't understand once again, the unintended consequences of serious students. Also had an impact, or let me ask how big an impact it had on integration. Certainly at that time, most of the schools, or a lot of them, were segregated.
It didn't have an immediate impact. In the South, African-American veterans had to go to historically black colleges and universities, of which there were relatively few. Or in many cases, they left the southern states altogether and went north and west. So it's estimated that about 20,000 African-American vets did not receive a higher education that they were entitled to under Title II of the GI Bill.
What about the effect? Did it have any impact, or was it a big factor in the migration north, or was that mostly jobs?
Probably more jobs, but there was some movement to more receptive universities. You'll see a surprisingly large number of Southern African Americans who have graduate degrees from places like Washington and Washington State, some of the California universities. They were seen as having opportunities available that weren't available in the South.
But as things opened up, did the historically black colleges and universities benefit? Were they able to grow?
Oh, sure. They grew. In fact, there was a separate piece of legislation that was passed that provided money for a capital construction in the historically black campuses. So they did grow.
And how about the curriculum itself? Did that have to change as a result of the students?
A little bit. The students weren't really interested in the liberal arts as much as they were in practical, career-oriented programs like business administration, engineering, to some extent teacher education. That's where the enrollments grew.
And what about the military itself, Dick? Was this seen as an incentive? Did the military see it immediately as something it could use as a recruitment incentive?
I don't think that was in their minds in the 1940s, Frank. I think that was understood to be the kind of traditional thing we do in the United States. We really reward our citizen soldiers. We only have reluctantly historically rewarded our professional, long-serving peacetime regulars. And this was really very much in the tradition of the Civil War bonus system and the World War I bonus.
We will talk more about the GI Bill, its impact, and its future. That's our conversation today. You can give us a call at 877-962-9862. Are the educational benefits of the GI Bill enough of a reward or an incentive these days for military service for men and women? That's just ahead on The State of Things. Taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. President Franklin Roosevelt signed the original GI Bill 60 years ago this year in June of 1944. Since then, the GI Bill has gone through a number of transformations. But there is still a GI Bill. It provides educational benefits to millions of GIs and their dependents. Today we're talking about that legislation, its impact on American society, the military, higher education, and you in the state of North Carolina. Joining us are Bob Serro, Professor of Educational Research and Leadership at NC State, and Dick Cohn is Chair of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at UNC Chapel Hill, and taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Bob, you talked earlier about the fact that while the GI Bill is credited with nearly creating the middle class in the United States, there was really one sort of on the rise, and it was emerging. But that was emerging at a time when the U.S. had plunged into a depression, then war. What was the likelihood that it would return to that sort of burgeoning or developing middle class without the GI Bill?
The GI Bill certainly helped, Frank, but the fact is that people were attending college in greater numbers. They were likely to, partly because of the scientific developments during the war. Science took off. Industry took off. The knowledge base that we had in society just kept growing as a result of things that were developed and discovered during World War II. So the GI Bill, again, provided some incentives to go to school, but the basic patterns, I think, had already been established.
Let's go to the phones. Bill is on the line from Greensboro. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, you have a question for us?
Yeah, I was a beneficiary of the GI Bill. I had 15 months active duty in the Marines, and they added a year, so I had 27 months, and I finished my college education. And my understanding was that time they paid your tuition wherever you were accepted. I went to a more expensive school than I would have gone to otherwise in Virginia, Washington, and Lee. Mm-hmm. And I never saw any of the money that they paid the school directly, and they also bought all my books, even notebook paper and stuff like that.
But
plus the fact I got $75 a month to live on.
But you were planning to go.
I was single, and that's uh-huh. why I got the $75. The other married people got more. I don't know how much because I wasn't one of them.
But you were planning to go anyway. You would have gone even without the federal money.
I'm having a hard time hearing you. I'm driving as I talk.
Well, I'm not going to keep you on any longer, Bill. That's outstanding.
I understood that you could go anywhere.
Yeah.
You were accepted, and the GI Bill would pay your tuition. of course, tuition at that time wasn't multiplied thousands.
Right.
I think it was something like $700, maybe a semester.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Bill, and your observation. It's something we hadn't thought about. I guess in some ways, sending more people to college drives up the cost, too. It makes it a more costly program to administer. But, you know, what is now the difference in the proportion that the GI Bill offers now in terms of educational benefits today versus what it did in the late 40s? Do you have an idea?
In the late 40s, it covered virtually everything. Some people did have to supplement the GI Bill benefits with part-time work, but for the most part, it covered 100% of cost at any university. Today, that's certainly not the case. The average cost of public education per year is about $14,000 in a four-year school, and the GI Bill will pay about $9,000 a year. So,
and there's also a big difference in the what the benefits for active duty versus National Guard and Reserves, right?
Right. The active duty people get about a little less than $3,000 a year versus $9,000 for the reserves get about $3,000 versus $9,000 for the active duty.
Active duty. Well, we're joined now by Ginger Bird. She's on the line from Boone, North Carolina. Ginger did serve in the Army National Guard for 6 years and joins us now. Hi, Ginger.
Hi.
How important was the GI Bill to you when you joined the National Guard?
It was very important, actually.
Yeah. Education, was that the big motivation?
Yes, because after high school, I went to college, and it was expensive, and I was injured in ball playing. And so I got out, came home, recovered, and decided to go into the Army.
Now, you did have a bit of a problem accessing your benefits. Isn't that true?
Yes. Now, I had to sign a six-year contract in order to receive benefits. That's the deal. You know, when you go in, you have to do that. I actually served 8 years. I served my six-year contract.
Right.
But because of stop loss, because of the war coming on after September 11th, I was sent to Afghanistan for a year. I came home for about 4 months and was sent to Iraq for a year.
So were you able then to get, so you served more, you served 8 years rather than six, which was the minimum, but you had a hard time getting the benefits, as I understand it, because you had not begun your education in the first 6 years. Am I correct?
Well, partly, yes. I had started the application at Appalachian State University, and when the war started, I was pulled out of that. Of course, I couldn't go, and I was sent to war. When I came back and went to start school, I was told I didn't have any educational benefits because I was not remaining active in the National Guard unit. They would not allow me to have my benefits.
And there was something about a broken service as well because there was an interruption in the service?
Yes, the way I understand it, which is it's very confusing, I was told that you got to serve two consecutive years on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the way they announced it to us as we were going over there. They said any time that we spent over there would be added on to our educational program.
Did you eventually end up getting, you eventually did end up getting the benefits?
No, I'm still,
oh,
working,
still working
on that. I've had to write a letter, and I'm hoping that something will change.
Dick Cohen, let me ask you about that. What's the difference in terms of service? I know that there's legislation now under consideration that would change at least one of those problems that Ginger had.
I think the feeling is that we have got to increase the benefits and we have got to make more efficient the delivery of the benefits. Frank, to be truthful, our entire personnel policies are under review in the Department of Defense. It's not well known, but the whole terms of service for the National Guard and the reserves is being called into question because they're being used as part-time regulars. They're not citizen soldiers for an emergency. When they sign on now, they know they are going to go on active duty, and they're probably going to go to war. In terms of making certain that we keep the ranks full in the active duty forces, we're now having, besides stop loss, to increase the bonuses to get people to reenlist. It's always more efficient to keep a trained soldier, sailor, airman, or marine, or Coast Guardsman on active duty than to get a new one. And so I think these benefits are going to be increased and perhaps dramatically. And at the same time, perhaps we're going to lower the length of service. Now you have to sign up for 3 or 4 years to get these benefits. There are now ways you can sign up for 2 years and still get some different benefits. It's a tremendously complex now system of inducements depending on what kind of contract you sign.
And, of course, part of the problem is advertising this. And, Ginger, I want to ask you, because I got the sense that you felt a bit misled. Maybe the advertising was something like false advertising.
Yes, partly, I guess. But I don't think the system was initially organized for National Guard members to be put in an active duty status, be able to be pulled out of school and then come back and finish that up. Unless you were going to stay in, I think the problem is that if you're getting out of the military, which I find it very appropriate for me to get out, because in order for me to stay in and go to school, I would be on that on-call situation, be pulled out of school at any point in time, and be sent to war or anywhere to do any kind of service. So I don't think it was originally designed for the National Guard members to be able to get their school benefits in this type of situation.
Right. But Dick, you're suggesting that now we're looking at that.
I think the services and Congress are looking at it. And, of course, there has been for some years a National Guard benefit in which if you agree to go in, National Guard would pay your education benefits before you actually go on your kind of active duty time. Do you know about that provision, Bob? I've seen our students at UNC in Army ROTC, for example, get recruited into the National Guard and get much higher educational benefits in terms of length of time and payments and so on.
But they get that before they actually...
Well, they go into the Guard and they're on the Guard. Yeah. They're in the Guard, yeah, and they're subject to being called, but it comes very much at the beginning of their service.
Well, Ginger, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ginger Bird served 6 years in the Army National Guard. She lives in Boone. We're taking your calls, talking about the GI Bill that turned 60 this year, 877-962-9862. Jenny's on the line from Carrboro. Hello, Jenny.
Hi.
Hi.
Yep. My question is just one of curiosity. I had friends who were, women friends who were in the service during World War II, and it was my understanding from what they said that the GI Bill did not pay women in those days to go to school. And I was just wondering if that was true and if the GI Bill eventually did help women go to school.
Bob?
Yeah, the GI Bill was available to women to varying degrees, but the education and training benefits were one of the packages that were wholly and totally available to women. Women could use those without any restrictions at all. So I understand that wasn't true of some of the other provisions, such as mortgages and unemployment benefits. But it was the case with education benefits. And the estimates are that about 3% of the people who used the benefits, the education benefits after the war, were women. That's roughly the same percentage of women that served in the military during World War II. So that was one of the provisions of the law that worked pretty well for women.
All right, Jenny, thanks for your call. The Army or the military did allow or provide an education, as I understand it, while you were serving, right? You could get a college degree while you were on active duty.
Right. There were a number of different programs during the war, but those were programs in which people were selected by the military, as opposed to the GI Bill, where you selected yourself.
How much of the educational benefits went to graduate work, and how much was undergraduate?
I've never seen any statistics on that. I'm guessing it's a relatively small amount. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much in the way of graduate education at that time. Probably, I would guess, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 or 20%.
Henry's on the line from Chatham County. Hi, Henry.
Hi there. Your listeners might be interested in the fact that England had a similar system called the Further Education and Training Grant. And it not only applied to demobilized members of the armed services, but to a special civilian group to which I belong, namely the, quote, Bevin boys. During the war, miners were short. the Minister of Labor, Ernest Bevin, set up a scheme whereby some 18-year-olds were forcibly drafted into the coal mines, but you could also volunteer. I was one of those who volunteered and worked in the coal mines, and when I was through, I came under the Further Education and Training Grant and got my grant to go to the London School of Economics.
Wow. That was, I don't know that we have anything like that, do we? Of course, we don't press people into civilian service
here. No, that's correct. And that was unusual, you see. What happened was that at the beginning of the war, coal mining had been was so disgustingly regarded by miners, and mm-hmm. correctly so, that all the young ones fled so that they were short, and Britain just had to have miners. And so Bevin set up this scheme at a time when war production peaked in the 43-44. And about 50,000 served, and I was there 2 weeks ago marching with Bevin boys down Whitehall, laying a wreath at the cenotaph at the memorial for the fallen soldiers, which had been established in 1919, and I was allowed to bear the wreath for the 50 of us Bevin boys who were allowed to march past.
Henry, how long were you in the mines?
I was about a year, because I was invalided out because I slipped twice on a rail and put out my knee and had to be out for 2 weeks each time. They said, look, that's enough.
How's the knee now?
It's great.
Oh, good. Well, thank you for your call, Henry.
All right.
877-962-9862. I guess the other thing this points out, this legislation, is that, I mean, here you had a problem. You had a very serious problem. What are we going to do with all these returning soldiers? The economy is not up to full speed. Well, I know we'll create this bill. And the federal government creates a program that solves a very serious problem, and it's a success. Is this a testament to what the government can do when everybody gets together and agrees that there is a problem and something should be done?
Well, mostly we criticize our government for terrible unintended consequences for legislation. And that great wartime leader Winston Churchill once said, there are two things you never want to see made, sausage and law. But in this case, I think it's an example of the power of government when it intervenes in the basic workings of society. We don't know, because it's counterfactual, of course, whether there would have been a depression after World War II, or what would have happened if these men hadn't had these opportunities. It was a great economic jump start. But I think it is indicative of the power of government in society, whether we like it or not.
But we've never really been able to replicate the GI Bill. We've tried. There have been four later versions of the GI Bill. None of them have been as generous as the original one. Now, on the other hand, some of the ideas that grew out of the original law have been manifested in other types of legislation that have been very successful. The whole idea of federal student aid, for example, comes from the GI Bill. There really wasn't anything like that before the war, but now there is. It's hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and that ultimately is a tribute to the effectiveness of the GI Bill. So Congress has a mixed record of trying to recreate the original GI Bill, I think.
Yeah, Gerald is on the line from Chapel Hill. Hello, Gerald.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good.
I'd call because I think one of the things which has not been stated was how close the bill came to not even passing. The original bill almost failed because Southern Democrats were opposing the bill because of the implications for returning black GIs that was tied into the bill. And if my memory serves me correctly, the bill almost failed. It took a heroic effort at the end by the American Legion and others to get the bill passed.
Well, let's get a response. Thank you, Gerald. Bob Serra?
Yeah, there was one Southern Democrat who was the chair of the Veterans Committee, and he did try to block it because of the racial provisions. But interestingly enough, the person who got it passed was another Southern Democrat from Georgia that the GI Bill put on an airplane the night before the bill was going to be voted on in committee, and he broke the logjam.
And why was that? Was it just because was he a longtime supporter of the bill?
Yeah, he had been sick. And so the American Legion dispatched a squad to go get him, put him on an airplane, and arrive at National Airport at midnight.
And there is, Bob, an exhibit at NC State, isn't there?
There is. It's the Transforming Society, the GI Bill Experience at NC State. It runs until December 22nd. It's a great exhibit.
What's there?
It's basically a history of the GI Bill at NC State and to some extent nationally. It's got pictures and artifacts and texts and a lot of personal memories about how the bill affected not just this one campus, but education generally.
It's on the main library on Hillsborough Street?
Right. It's the D.H. Hill Library on Hillsborough Street.
So are the changes ahead, do you think, going to make this as spectacular and have the kind of impact, the continuing impact that it has had, or is just the sheer magnitude and scope of the number of GIs and the cost of education, et cetera, make that impossible?
I think that when you realize how many GIs in a society half our size, 16-plus million GIs in a society of 135 million people, that would be over 32 million people now. I think it's now, military service is still an avenue of upward mobility. It still has many benefits for the people who choose to do it. But it's a much smaller percentage of our society now. Perhaps 1% of our people serve in uniform. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly now a recruiting and retention tool for our armed forces. While it has those social benefits, I think it's a very different thing today.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that, the impact currently in society, the effort to use the GI Bill, the modern iteration of that bill as a recruiting tool, and take more of your phone calls, 877-962-9862, if you want to continue the conversation on the GI Bill. On the State of Things, stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We are talking about the GI Bill, which turned 60 this year, its impact on American society, the military, and higher education. And with us today are Bob Serro, Professor of Educational Research and Leadership at NC State, and Dick Cohn, Chair of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at UNC Chapel Hill. And we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Dick, you were talking, too, about the relationship and what this bill tells us about the relationship between the civilian population and the military, and it's one we don't often think about.
It isn't. We tend to think of civil-military relations as just the connection between the senior politicians and the senior military. But in fact, the U.S. military and any military establishment is a great force in society in many ways. And the relationship between the civilian and the military is an enormous element of our civic life. We know that here in North Carolina, where we have large bases and many military people. It's a presence in our state. And here, with this piece of legislation, you see the government making a specific effort to head off some problems. It sets in motion some change, and it really brings into stark relief the importance of this relationship in society.
Now, does it suggest that we've actually become utterly dependent on this? I mean, does it mean that we could not back away from or do without the enormous impact that military spending has?
I think we could do without it, but doing without it would entail great disruption. There are places in the country that are dependent on those payrolls. Certainly our foreign policy, our position in the world is dependent upon our military force. We have a military establishment that has much greater power, much greater reach than any other nation's. And there's, in many ways, great and small, it affects our society. When we shrank that military establishment in the early 1990s, it caused real hardship in some areas, particularly Southern California, where many bases, I think over 20 bases were closed in California in the 1990s alone. And it's not just bases that have these impacts. It's businesses. It's the way in which the draft shaped American youth from 1940 to 1973. There are many, many aspects of its influence.
Well, one last question, its impact, and I want to put a version of this to both of you. But Dick, first you, the impact on the military. How important a tool is this, these kind of incentives for recruiting?
They're indispensable. Not everyone can be induced to enlist for reasons of patriotism or for salaries or for benefits. There are a lot of young men and women who see service in the armed forces as a way to improve themselves. And just cash benefits would not do it. They want education. They want those kinds of help in achieving their own personal goals. And I think most students of military personnel who tend to see this as an economic model, as a labor issue, would tell you that these kinds of things are indispensable along with the salaries and the bonuses.
Well, Bob, we heard about the impact immediately after the war. How big an impact, how big a factor is the GI Bill and this kind of educational benefit for higher education?
Well, you'll see its effects mostly in the area of community colleges, Frank. The benefits have traditionally been small under the current iteration of the law. They have been raised about 50% in the last 5 years, but the benefits have been small to the point that most people can't use them for 4 years. They want to take their benefits at once and use them for a two-year program, such as you'll find in community colleges. But the spirit of the original GI Bill is alive and well in things like AmeriCorps and in the loan forgiveness policies of the federal government. You'll see that people can teach or they can be in law enforcement or nursing, and they'll get part of their student loan forgiven if they provide this national service.
I want to thank you both very much. Bob Cerro, Professor of Educational Research and Leadership at NC State. Dick Cohn is Chair of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
We're going from the GI Bill to jazz on the state of things. The State of Things, I'm Frank Stacio. The story of Mary Magdalene is not one that inspires many jazz musicians, but it did inspire DeFilio, I should say DelFilio Marsalis.
That's close. DelFilio.
Now, let me just get it right here.
Yeah.
It's close enough for jazz. No, you don't want me to say
it's close enough for classical. You know, we have a saying with the jazz bands. When I go to different schools, and a lot of guys are in the orchestra, and they play in a jazz band, and sometimes they think that it's a nice relief. You know, they can just take it easy. And I always tell them, I said, if you want to crack some notes, if you want to miss parts, you got to go to the orchestra. I said, jazz is the precision music,
it's
baby.
It's the precision music.
You got to get it right. DelFilio.
DelFilio Marsalis is here. He's in North Carolina this week performing tonight with the Duke Jazz Ensemble. We're listening to a tune called, that has to do with the story of Mary Magdalene. It is a part of a larger piece that is a sort of a biblical work. And I want to talk to you about that, about the themed work that you compose and perform. But we first have to talk about the fact that you're a trombone player.
Okay.
What were you thinking?
I don't
know. It's a tough
instrument
to get a gig, right?
Yeah, well, you know, in growing up in New Orleans, we have a lot of musical families. And I guess I would say we started off by, we played football. Wenton was a quarterback. I was a wide receiver. And that was just kind of how it went. So when it came time to choose an instrument, it never occurred to me to play something that my other brothers were playing. Grant was playing saxophone. Wenton was playing trumpet. My dad had the piano. And I actually wanted to play the electric bass, but it hurt my fingers. So I said, no, I don't want to do that. So I looked at the trombone. I said, that looks like an instrument no one would want to play. So I'll go ahead and tackle it. So that's how it started.
Started and has turned out very well. And it is true that I don't know a lot of very successful, you know, guys who can really make a living and a name for themselves playing that instrument. I saw your brother once say it's one that's hard to define. He still doesn't always hear it, except when you play.
Well, you know, we've had guys over the years. The big trombone-led bands have been big bands. Tommy Dorsey had one of the finest bands around, Glenn Miller. And it was always used as part of a larger ensemble. Of course, in the modern era, J.J. Johnson is one of the finest players, but he was also not able to sustain a band. So it's kind of different, especially when you're playing modern jazz. But you usually find that the trombone's part of a larger ensemble.
Your music, you're known not only for your playing, but also as a producer. You've produced some 70, I think. 70,
I produced a number of things,
at least.
Yeah. Yes.
And let's talk about this composition, Pontius Pilate's Decision. Mm-hmm. We have essentially what is known in scriptural terms as the Passion,
right?
Laid out here. This is reminiscent, I guess, of the program music of the 19th century, something like that, where you're telling a story.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know how much you're familiar with Louisiana political history, but around the early 1990s, David Duke was running for office, and he was nearly elected. Yeah. He got into a runoff for governor. Yeah. And I found a parallel in certain ways with the biblical story. You had a governor back then who made a questionable decision. We had people who voted much like, and I mean, the situation was clearly different. But I think that, you know, the people basically voted for Barabbas instead of Christ. So I said, man, you know, this is interesting. A lot of people wanted David Duke in office, even though he was really on a kind of a slippery moral ground. Yeah. So that's really what started it. And, you know, I started to make that parallel, and the songs just kind of came up.
But I want to ask you about that process. Do you think intellectually and begin to see a story and then try to, you know, almost like a tone poem, illustrate that? Or is there something more abstract that happens between you and the story?
Well, it works both ways. The crucifixion, for example, I sat down with the intent of writing a theme based on my interpretation of what that situation must have been like, what the environment was like at the time. Whereas The Weary Ways of Mary Magdalene, that was actually an existing song, and it kind of had that sound to it. I said, Weary Ways.
Yeah.
It has that kind of feel. So I think it can work both ways. And I think with any composer, when you look at the overall view of our scope, one of the most well-known of the modern classical pieces, The Victims of Hiroshima by Penderecki, and that is well-known that he didn't actually write it for that. You know, it was written an already existing piece, but he decided to entitle it The Victims of Hiroshima. And, you know, and if you study classical composition, that's one of the main pieces, you know, because it's very effective.
Well, that even happened, you know, in the Middle Ages, sort of the medieval tone poems, madrigals, where they were sort of illustrated musically whether it was going to rain, you know, the notes would tumble down and that sort of thing. Hmm. But it doesn't sound, and that's why I bring that up, because it's not that literal in your composition. Let's listen to another cut from that, Adam's Ecstasy and Eve's Delight. Composition called Pontius Pilate's Decision. Delphio Marsalis is my guest. Adam's Ecstasy, Eve's Delight. And as our producer pointed this out to me, I didn't hear it myself the first time through, but she heard it. Is there a hint of my funny Valentine? Did you?
That's
a little,
funny.
Little sampling?
Yeah.
It's in there?
It is, indeed.
Way to go,
it's
Corey.
It's in a different key, but you know, when you're composing things, just you use whatever is available to you, and it does kind of have that flavor to it. That wasn't my intent when I originally wrote it.
I saw one of the reviews. One of the reviewers wrote something like, "Okay, go ahead and ignore the text and ignore the titles and the drawings, and just go ahead and enjoy it for the music." And how do you feel about a review like that?
Right. I think he was even less kind than that. But, you know, I think the problem that we have with reviewers is only that it's hard for them to accept a piece of work based on the merit of what it actually is. They have to read into, so this was my first CD. So, you know, a number of guys felt that I felt that I had to do a grandiose thing, you know, because of, you know, the success of my older brothers and this and that. And I think that he really missed the boat. because I think that this Pontius Pilate's decision was, I think it's well conceived, it's well structured, well thought out, the performance is strong, and, you know, I think that maybe he wasn't it's funny because the people at RCA, the record label, were like, well, most of the people in the label are Jewish. He's like, they don't even read the Bible. You know, why do you have to do these biblical themes? And I said, well, I respect that they're not, but I grew up Catholic, and these are, you know, this is thematic material that's important to me. And they were just really, they tried to just get me to forget the Bible themes, just put it out, rename all the songs. That's where they were coming from.
But the whole business of themes and putting together a concept like this seems to be a hallmark of your career. You seem to like putting things together. This is what a producer does. You've produced a lot of albums. Is the composition the most fun part? Is that where you get the big charge?
Well, keep structuring things, yes. Yeah. Yes, because it's one thing to be able to be a fine performer and to play, and we all strive to, you know, for virtuosity, but to really make a statement from front to back, I think, is a powerful thing. Many people have one good song on a record or two good songs, and I think that's fine, but I pride myself in thinking of things similar to the way that Beethoven or Mozart would compose larger works. So I'm really hoping to continue to do larger works.
I'm not going to. I don't want to define you in terms of your brothers, but you know, there they are. And I've also read that you might be seen as the sort of compromise between Witten's tight control, absolute control over the music, and Branford's much more improvisational style.
Right. Well, it was unfortunate for Witten and for all of us who love modern music in the '80s when Branford and Kenny Kirkland left his band, because, you know, that was for us the hallmark band, and improvisational music, you need individuals. The greater the musicians, then the more leeway, the more latitude you give them. And unfortunately, he went and has had great bands throughout the years, but none with the improvisational prowess of that early band. So it actually worked out better for Wynton. It's like a strange thing for us who love the improvisation. When that band broke up, it was heartbreak. But it worked out better because Wynton then got into more into composition, larger works, and bigger bands. So I think there's also a misunderstanding. People say, well, why doesn't he go back to this, or why doesn't he do this? And it's not a question of him not wanting to return, but not having the musicians. So I think that's been Wynton's problem. As far as you know, Branford goes, yeah, he, in my opinion, and I've told him this, could use a little more structure. He likes to just leave it a little too loose. Mm-hmm. So
So maybe you are the
I guess
the
you could look at it that way. You know, I think it's been good for me to work for both of them. I think that both Branford and Wynton have benefited from being able to work with me, or have me, you know, produce their records. And I've certainly benefited from being around them. And I always look to them for inspiration.
And that works okay? They'll take advice from their little brother if you're in the studio?
Yes, you know, it's that little brother thing. You know, they won't admit it up front, but, man, shut up, you don't know what you're talking about. And then they'll secretly go and tell the musicians.
Secretly go ahead and do it. Well, we really appreciate you talking with us today.
No problem.
Good luck tonight. Okay. Delfeo Marsalis performs at the Duke Jazz Ensemble at 8 p.m. tonight, the concert at Baldwin Auditorium on the East Campus of Duke University in Durham. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. You can drop us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Frank Stachow.